This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
And yes, indeed, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, every morning, every Friday morning, that is, 9 o'clock or thereabouts. And we do guests, and we do conversations, and sometimes we do conversations about the world's geopolitics, and sometimes we do conversations about nuclear physics, and sometimes we do conversations about household economics, and sometimes we do conversation about the arts. Theater, painting, music, dance. And today we're going to concentrate rather aggressively on theater. And we have two different guests, very different kinds of work. And I think that between the two of them, it's a nice rounded picture. My first guest today is the actor Becky Nkwane. Becky has this I got a resume from him, a CV, which is 2 pages long and which includes all manner of productions on stage, for television, roles in television serials, in movies, in productions that have traveled internationally. But I must tell you, the thing that intrigued me the most, buried in the midst of this resume, is the phrase, he was working as a security guard and a dispatch clerk when he got intrigued by theater and was drawn into it. Being a security guard is not the usual pathway to becoming a renowned actor. And so, Becky, I'm really pleased to have you join us today. But tell me, how did you go from security guard to internationally recognized actor? What's the path?
Brooks, morning, and thanks so much for having me in your program. Brooks, it's a little stint that I had when I had just finished school. I had just finished matric, and there was no work around. This is back in the 1980s, you know, and I had a 6-month stint in being a security guard. And with my work today, I've always known that I wanted to be an actor. I will tell you my inspiration. When I was young, my big brothers, two of them, I would think I was almost 12, if not 11, they took me to go and watch Gibson Cantor Productions. This is a touring company that used to come from Johannesburg and tour around our townships in Durban, in Guamashu. Mm-hmm. So I grew up almost every year. I would watch 2 productions of Gibson Cantor a year. And I got inspired. I think how I got inspired, like I was 13 years old, but I would go back after watching those productions. And in my dreams, I will dream mimicking those people, if not rubbing shoulders with them on stage. That's how theater beat me. That's where it started. I got so interested. And then later, of course, I started my own township groups in the township, sort of like directing and writing. It was then later that I got picked up by Rob Amato, who was a professor in English Department of University of KZN. He saw us rehearsing a piece in a township, and he invited me to come along and work with him in the premises of Howard College to adapt one of Moliere's plays. And we adapted it into He's Not a Doctor, and we co-directed and I acted a lead. It is then that a person like Nicholas Ellenbogen was appointed as an artistic director of the Playhouse, the Loft Theatre, came to see our show, and he invited me to come and join the Loft Theatre. Then the rest was history, because I ended up being in the Loft Theatre for almost 12 years, 6 years with Nicholas Ellenbogen, and then I hang around when the Loft Theatre was gone. I hang around there working under acting Ronnie Govender, and then later Stephen Gaine, and then later work under Linda Bukosini. So I almost spent 12 years at the Playhouse, and then I ventured into Johannesburg to go for the mainstream.
You know, that's quite a lineage to go from being a child sitting there watching works by one of the grand masters of South African theater, Gibson Kente. You probably saw his work about the same time I was first introduced to it, or maybe a little bit later. And then in some serious stages with Nicholas Ellenbogen, and then at the Playhouse Theater in Durban. But the range of the work that you were involved in, spanning things like from Molière to Master Harold and the Boys, that's also quite a range. I mean, where do you find your center? Where do you find the work that most speaks to you?
I think I've reached a level as an actor where I'm very clear when it comes to the theater that I don't look at my work as per style. Because it's true. I mean, if you remember Love Theater, and later I worked for years with Ellis Pearson, we were branded as physical theater actors. I truly struggle with that one because it's true. Today, when I conduct master classes, I always make sure that I focus in the use of the body, the use of sound, which could be dialogue or whatever, and the use of space. Therefore, what I'm trying to say to you, Brooke, is that I don't choose work to do because I've done classical, I've done simple straight plays, I've done storytelling, I've done physical, I've done stylized theater. And that's the language that I constantly use if I'm involved in a show. So I don't choose, but I can do anything just because of that experience and the training that I come along with.
When I looked through your resume, and I read it several times to find a nice entry point for me. One of the things that struck me as really interesting, you mentioned the play Tsepung, which had been put together by Laura Foote some years ago. It's an absolutely searing drama, and I remember seeing it with Mcidisi Shabangu a couple times, and each time it leaves you startled and stunned. But it's almost in its original format, it's almost entirely written in English, or in the case of the second person on stage, pure physical theater because she has no words. And then it says you reworked it into isiZulu. Did it change the work, or did it make it bigger or stronger or more intimate or easier to understand or harder? How talk to me about the transformation of the work.
No, with Tsepang, when I saw when it came out for the first time, I was very inspired. But one thing that sat with me, because when it came out, it was a time where I'm so interested to take our stories back to our people. But of course, the thing was that, Peggy, you would waste energy to take this story in English and take it to our people. It could be very sad because I wanted to visit the rural areas to take this story to. If you remember, my inspiration with Ellis, we used to perform under the big tree. We used to perform in villages and whatever. So that was my interest. And then I met a great friend of mine, you would know him, Maurice Podbury, who lives in Canada, working as an artistic director in one of the theater companies there. When I met him, he said to me, "Peggy, what are you up to in these years?" I said, "Maurice, you are a producer of Tsepang. Could you allow me to adapt it into Zulu and take it to the rural areas?" Just to make a point, because when I adapted this work, there was a lot of violence and woman abuse and whatever. And I thought this work could speak powerful to the people, but it must be done in their own language. You know, if I could still do that, I would be happy to do it in Tswana, Pedi, Zulu, Xhosa, and take it to the villages because it's such a powerful story. But the point was that I wanted the story to be received by the people because it's a
Did it
story that
change
belonged
the
to the people.
nature of how it was told by there is the view that translation is always something of a lie, When you take a work and you reconfigure it or you reimagine it in yet another language, how hard was it to keep the core of the work in its transition from English to Zulu? Did that give you?
With Tsepang, you must remember, it's a story that is told by two African characters. And the actor who's driving it, whom you might call in our style, you must say narrating the story and revisiting the story, is one actor, and the actress is busy muted. But if you look at that actor was reporting the landscape of where the story took place and the people who were involved. So I didn't change anything other than I actually translated it, reinterpreted it word for word as per character. That's what I did. And the impact was very interesting. One night I was performing the show in KCAP, which is KwaMashu Arts Center in
Becky,
Durban.
can I pause you just for a second? We have to do a station. Hold that thought. We're going to come
Yes.
right back to it. This is the Deep
Yes.
Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. My guest today, Becky Mukwani.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Becky Mukwani, and I just interrupted him as he was going to explain how the work was carried through. We're talking about the play Tsepang, if you hadn't heard the preceding few minutes. Becky, go ahead, please. Go ahead, continue with the story.
No, Brooks, I was just sharing an experience that I had. I was on stage in KwaMashu one night performing this Tsepang, which I translated it. I translated the title as well, and I call it Ithemba Lethu, which means our hope, Tsepang. So in the middle of the performance, where there was one big moment, which is a climax of this play, where the baby is raped, the little infant is being raped. And I heard a groan, a very disturbing groan, almost like a lion, of a man going, "Ooh!" Everyone was disturbed in the theater, And suddenly this man broke down. He started crying. The rest of the play, he was even taken out. It turned out this man once raped his daughter. So the play made him to revisit that. He was disturbed. Broke down and cried because he was dealing with that the first time through Tsepang. That was one incident that stood out for me with this play when it was translated in Zulu. And when that moment happened, I remember asking myself that if it was in English, do you think that man would have been affected like that? Because it's true. I mean, we take languages for granted. Languages is always powerful when you are telling a story. The story is well received if it's told in the people's language. You can't come and impose. I remember one experience of Peter Brook, who came all the way down to Ethiopia with his troupe in the early days of his company, and they performed in French, and the people couldn't understand a thing. The next day, he decided to tell his actors, "Let's use gibberish, try and create a language that doesn't exist." Only then they got the response.
We're talking about a version of post-traumatic stress. You're talking about the man in the audience who suddenly had to confront his own inner demons and crimes through the power of language. I'll give you an alternate way of looking at this. Years ago, I saw the production César, which is a reworking of the well-known Julius Caesar by Shakespeare, only it's done in Sesotho. And my knowledge of
I know.
Sesotho is about three words. If I knew the play well enough that I was with the dramatic flow of the actors on stage, almost line by line, because like every kid in the world, I guess, we had to study it in high school in two or three different grades and somewhere in the university as well, and probably seen film versions of it. But that was because it had already been imprinted on me.
But Brooks, when I taught Australia a lot because I used to do this annual festival in Australia, in Perth. Then we got to be invited by one of the artistic director in the theater called His Majesty Theatre. And they were doing Midsummer Night Dream. It was performed by the Pakistanians and Indians. I understood everything. They were performing it in their mother tongue. It was, I think it was produced by British Art Council. And on stage, you had all of these Pakistani and Indian unpacking Midsummer Night Dream in their own language. I was so thrilled. When they finished the performance, they got almost 45 minutes standing ovation, but they didn't speak any word of English. That's why I got inspired. I remember turning to Ellis Pearson and saying, "Justice Ellis, we have to start doing these things." You know, I was trying to get to the Market Theatre. I spoke to Greg, but then I think Lara decided no, because I wanted to mount it at the Market Theatre, Mount Tsepang in Zulu. But then Lara maybe wants to do it or whatever, but she's the owner of the rights of the show, so she refused.
We're talking about your past work, and we're talking
Yeah.
about the inner workings of your own mind about how theater should convey its message. But I think the reason why we're talking with you now is that you have a master class which you're offering to the public coming up in about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks from now.
On the 7th of next month at Pop Archer.
And Pop Art is on Dorset Road, which is in, I forget, which is it, Parkview or Parkwood at that point? I think it's
I think it's
Parkview.
part of Parkview,
And
if I'm not mistaken. I don't know that area.
I mean, it's easy to find. Dorset
Yeah.
Road is not that big, and it's pretty and it's convenient. And there's parking, and it's on a Saturday morning. You're running this from what, 8:30 to 3 in the afternoon?
From 9:30 to 3:30.
That is a
Yeah.
lot of time to fill for one performer delivering a master class. How do you deliver what is, after all, a 6-hour lesson? How do
You'll
you
be
break it
shocked.
up?
It's not enough, actually, because masterclass, there is a difference between the masterclass and the workshop. I keep explaining this thing. A workshop is when you take people through a certain discipline. Either it's an acting discipline, you sit with that, or either it's a writing discipline, you sit with that, or either it's directing discipline. That's a workshop, and you pick up a subject and you unpack and analyze that subject. But the way I look at teaching masterclass, it's an individual trying to unpack his experiences and how he processes his work, which becomes like sharing your artistry, you know, and help others with exercises of actually investigating about their world.
And
That's a master class.
so you're going to
To
make.
say, to say, to say, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I wouldn't have done this, but I started working on myself because it was a self-block. I had these limitations as an actor. This is how I dealt with it. And today, look at where I am. Those are master classes.
Yeah, well, I am not your candidate because I am the world's worst actor. I mean, there's nothing you can do to fix me. I've often told the story about how I ruined an entire high school production of a musical. I had a total
Yeah.
of four words, two lines, and one of the words was repeated, and I managed to get them backwards, and the entire cast was flummoxed through the entire act as a result of my miscue. So
Yeah.
I'm really not the person you could even use as an experimental subject. You know, make me better.
We can try.
Yeah, I will test the limits of your skill. Let me put it that
Yeah,
way. If I
let's have you. Let's have you to come and attend the master class. You'll be blown. You'll be taken away.
may do it. It's not very far from my house. I may just roll down the hill and get there.
Would be nice to have you, Brooks, because it's true. The master class that I'm doing, it's not about being an actor. It's about being a teller in the bank. It's about being a petrol attendant, because it's the idea of how do you receive a client with a certain energy. That's why when I'm conducting this master class, I don't talk about acting, I talk about performance. What elements do you borrow from to produce an exciting performance? So it's not about acting, it's performing. I'm sure in our own world, everyone needs performance.
I
Yeah.
remember Barney Simon years ago with the play Woza Albert.
Yeah.
He sent his actors off. Both of them were already actors, obviously, and he sent them off to go spent some time with homeless people, so that they picked up the style, the mannerisms, the texture of
Yeah.
that rather than acting.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because
And
it's
that
true.
was.
It's true. We are struggling today just because some of the institutions out there, they always struggle to explain what is our work as actors. And kids, they come out of these institutions, they misdirected, you know. I'll tell you what I'm building up to. It is very clear for me that most of the institutions in this country, they're using 99% of Eurocentric approach into acting, you know, and they spend time with these kids, sort of like trying to dissect the ideas of the West, but we are in Africa. So it is about time now that when we do that, find a balance, try and do 50-50 of that, so that we help our kids, whether they're black, yellow, whatever. We help them to realize that in Africa, they will always act Africa. That's nothing else
Yeah,
other than that.
that's a whole long entire conversation we'll have to
Oh,
have
yeah.
separately. Unfortunately, our time with you, because of your schedule, has just about run out. But let's remind listeners, your workshop, your master class at the Pop Art Center, Pop Art Theater on Dorset Road in Parkview, March 7, 9:30
Yeah.
to 3:30. All comers are welcome, or is there a limit to the number of bodies you can squeeze in, or how do you work this?
No, everyone is welcomed. There's no limit.
All righty.
Yeah.
We've been speaking with Becky Mkwani, actor, stage, film, television, master class leader, one time security guard, now an internationally known actor in local plays, in international plays. Been great fun. I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you.
Brooke, thanks so much for inviting me into your space. Thanks so much. And thanks to your viewers as well.
And we will be back after these messages with another conversation on theater. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is part two of today's deep dive. I'm still your host, Brooke Spector. The second guest for today, Malcolm Perkey. Malcolm has been a long-time acquaintance and friend over many years, and he is now in yet a different incarnation to when I first met him in terms of work. Now he and I'm never quite sure of the title. What is it? It's not general manager, it's manager of programs or
Hi, Brooks. It's
yeah.
lovely to be here again.
What do we call your
I'm
job?
called, my official title is Consulting Director
Okay.
of the Wits Theatre Complex, and I was brought back to rejuvenate and reactivate the Wits Theatre, which had been in a very bad state since COVID and even before.
That includes more than just a venue. You're sort of branching out to include foyers and other places
Well,
and
the Wits Theatre itself has a main theatre, and it has two other smaller theatres. It has the foyer. And I'll tell you about the lovely things we are doing in the foyer. I'm also nominally in charge of the Great Hall, which is mostly for graduations. And I'm involved with the Chris Seabrook Music Hall.
Oh, that was the one I was trying to think of.
Yeah,
That's
yeah.
the new one.
So there's quite a lot of stuff going on in all those venues.
And they're all clustered very closely together, which is nice.
Yep. And in fact, I'm sure there are many things we can talk about, but perhaps we should start with the idea that's been floated for many years of a Wits Cultural Precinct. And the Wits Cultural Precinct, based on a document that I created, is generally an idea to connect all these existing spaces, and even as far as the Origin Center, with literal walkways, landscaping, and really make it a very powerful and wonderful place to visit. Not just for the venues, but for cafes and for sitting and for engaging and so on.
An urbane urban landscape.
That is correct. And of course, we should never forget Wham, which is on the corner.
Yeah.
And there's a huge effort to open up to Bromfontein, which is rapidly rejuvenating as well.
And once you get as far as the Wits Art Museum and Bromfontein, You are literally just a small stone's throw to the Joburg Theatre as well, to be included in the grander vision.
Well, years back, there was the idea of the so-called ARC, which went from the Joburg Theatre to the Bits Theatre, across the bridge to the Market Theatre, and on into Newtown. And at least nominally, that still exists. And as we, I suppose, reclaim the city and make it livable again and healthy again, these visions can become a reality.
Over time.
Absolutely. But there's been a lot of movement recently.
Well, I mean, we should foreground this a bit by saying that Malcolm comes to this job. He taught at Vitz for many years.
20.
And he was artistic director at the Market Theatre for 8 years and a bit.
Almost a decade, in fact, because I started a bit earlier as a consultant.
Okay.
And then I went to AFTA for 10 years, first as a dean, then as a curriculum developer, and then teaching writing. And in the last 2 years, give or take, there'll be June, end of June will be 2 years, I've been working at the Bits Theatre again, so I'm rather loving it.
And we can add that he's had a couple of stints overseas as a graduate student and as a as an honored guest lecturer professor, working again in theatre, and I'm sure taken various productions to places like the Edinburgh Festival and so forth.
All of that. And most recently, I spent a year in Baltimore at the university, Towson University, and we made a wonderful project called Icarus at the Border. And I'm beginning to be rather obsessed with Greek mythology, because there was a lot of Greek mythology in that play, mixed in with a bit of Freud and mixed in with time travelers and student work and puppetry and so on. So I hinted at this for you, Brooks. I'm writing a new play with a young man who has a real life experience about a trance who is born a girl and grows up in over 20 years, becomes a man, who happens to be obsessed with Greek mythology. And it's called The Breasts of Tiresias. And I didn't make that name up. It's borrowed from Apollinaire, who wrote a play way back, over 100 years ago.
I was going to say that he's dead.
Well, he's dead and, you know, he's with the angels. But it was the first time the word surrealism was used.
Ah, okay.
And so we are honoring those kinds of ideas, although the play is completely different. Not completely different, because his play is about a woman who wants to become very active and gives up her breasts to become so. And her husband, who's really anxious about the population of the village, gives birth to 40,009 children in one day.
You hear a pause here because I'm busy trying to take that all in.
I know. But perhaps we should go back to the Bits Theatre and talk about what's going on. So on Saturday night, we have this fantastic concert. Carlo Mombelli, Msaki, Kyle Shepherd, Marcus Wyatt, Jono Sweetman, and it's sold out. And that's wonderful because it's taken a while to get audiences to trust the Bits Theatre again. We assure the public that there is quality parking inside the campus. Just come to Station Street and they'll let you in after hours and on Saturdays. And it's going to be a wonderful concert.
Station Street is the one most of us tend to think of as the not quite main entrance to the Bits campus.
That's correct. It's on the southeast corner of the campus, right near WAM, and a couple of blocks away from Tsimolokgeng, where I hope to join Wits Theatre to Tsimolokgeng with a blue road.
Okay.
It's part of the Wits Cultural Precinct.
And beyond this concert for tomorrow, because
Saturday, okay,
yeah,
tomorrow.
Because we're recording this now, but it'd be broadcast Friday morning, so Saturday.
Okay. What's next?
You have other things. You went through this with me.
No, my job has been to animate the venue, and what I love most is curating. I have to deal with HR and I have to deal with budgets and I have to deal with all these terrible things that the university wants people like myself to sort out. But mostly I love curating. And I'm delighted to report that Sophia Town, Aubrey Sahabi's production from the State Theatre, is coming to the Fitz Theatre, at the Wits Theatre in April and May to play for the schools because it's still a national set work. And please may I celebrate with you, Brooks. We have sold 1 million copies of the publication, which Wits University Press and Macmillan jointly produced.
And for those listeners who are not familiar with the play Sophia Town, play musical, I mean, okay.
A play with music, as I used to call it.
It is one of the great seminal works that came out of an earlier era in this country, which speaks to the imminent destruction of Sophia Town as a mixed race community. And it's drawn in part from an actual historical circumstance in terms of the actual characters.
So,
Am I being opaque enough here?
yeah, I can help you though. Journalists from Drum Magazine, Lewis and Corsi and Nat Nakasa, placed an advert in the paper
That's where I
for
was
real,
going.
for real. And the advert read, "Wanted one Jewish girl to come and stay with them in Sophia Town." And according to the account in Drum Magazine by Jim Bailey, and in spite of all the odds, a Jewish girl answered the ad and went to stay there. Now, we knew we wanted to deal with the 50s because we were working our way in Junction Avenue through history. But once we found that little bit of a mad snippet, we knew we had a play. Because when you take a stranger into a community, each group has to account to the other and explain who they are and what their cultural references are and what their behavior is and what their rituals are. And it became an amazing workshop and then play that we opened at the Market in 1986, and it's never stopped playing. Aubrey Sahabi's production now with a band, so now it's more of a musical.
I'm going to break just for a minute. We have to do commercial and station breaks. If we don't, ICASA and our sponsors will have me by the throat. So we will do that, and then we'll be right back with the second half of our second part of today's deep dive, this time with Malcolm Perkey as our guest. We'll be right back after these messages. As we used to say in radio a zillion years ago, don't touch that dial. Stay with us.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And in our second half of today's broadcast, now we're speaking with Malcolm Perkey, who is in charge of all the multivariate facilities at the University of the Witwatersrand that deal with cultural output, with art, with not art, art, but the arts.
Art and culture,
Yeah.
as we call it, including theatre, physical theatre, music, and of course, fine arts. It's all there in all the venues, and I am involved mostly with the performing arts.
You were talking about the kernel of truth that is at the heart of the play Sophia Town, which Malcolm is one of the primary creators of, and now is coming back in a new production by Aubrey Sahabi, as you said. There's an interesting parallel. I'm not sure if you know about it. The opera, Madame Butterfly.
Well, that's about, as I remember, I think an American who finds himself in a community of what we now call others, and I guess falls in love, finds out many things. Is that correct, Bruce?
Well, he's a naval officer and he buys a bride for a while
Ah.
through an advertisement.
Ah.
And it's actually based on a snippet of a newspaper article about a marriage that goes sour. It was first turned into a play, and a first short story, and then a play, and then ultimately an opera. So it too has had a series of iterations and reinterpretations. Someday I'd love to see the two of them put together.
Well, I wonder if that will ever happen. But I suppose what was very
I have
important,
dreams, Malcolm. I have dreams.
what was very important for us always in Junction Avenue Theatre Company, one of our principles was revelation of hidden history, which meant that history was very important to us and was deeply linked to the new historical studies or history studies at Wits in the earlier days of the 70s and 80s. And so we were committed to doing a lot of research on anything we did, even if we then took liberties as we fictionalized the pieces. But because of that historical tone, somehow we managed to reach two audiences in a big way.
I have to tell you, I've seen it several different times by various productions. And although I know how it ends, and I'm not going to tell audiences if I haven't seen it, I sit there and at the last 5-6 minutes, I'm startled each time by the effect of the revelation.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, when we first opened in the small venue at the Market Theatre, Manny Manum, who was then the producer, said to us, the last 20 minutes is electrifying, shocking, painful. And it's still that, because what else can it be? I mean, it's no big deal to reveal the secret that this play is built on the destruction of Sophia Town by the then Afrikaner nationalists and the apartheid regime. And what they built after that was called Triumph, which we know as Triumph, which is a very strange thing to do.
And now it's called Sophia Town again.
Yes, circles and circles and cycles and cycles.
And there is a very good novel about it called Triumph.
Well, there you go.
Anyway, so you have that and you have more stuff yet coming up that you were mentioning.
Yes, well, we on the 16th of May, we are having a concert by the very famous and wonderful Kesava Naidu mm-hmm. and his troupe.
Super, super musician, by the
way. And he's launching his new album in our theatre, so we're very pleased with that. And one of the first achievements that I managed to get in place about after 6 months working on this rather sad theatre then was to have a Carl Shepherd in concert, also launching his album, and that helped get us back on the map. And so now we're on the map and we, you know, selling out. But Kesava Naidu, I hope you'll also sell out. And then we are...
Once you put the lion in a cage, you have to throw an occasional sheep over the fence.
Yes, we're going to throw some sheep over the fence. If everything goes well, we're going to do an experiment where the Emerging Wits Orchestra mm-hmm. is going to play in our venue. And there's different debates about the acoustics of the venue for orchestra. So before we play, we're going to have a test where we do a rehearsal with various sound experts in the venue to test it and see if it's as bad as some people say. If it's okay, then we'll be delighted to host the Wits Orchestra.
Can I ask a question about
may,
that?
You may.
Do you have a lot of venues that are, you know, barely okay? They fix it somewhat by putting a backdrop sound shield.
Well, you know how they're very, very expensive.
You know what I'm talking about.
No, you drop down a special kind of quality of material that somehow works with the sound to push it out into the auditorium.
Yeah, because you want a slight delay, but not much.
No, so it's unfortunately, I'm told, very expensive.
Yeah,
but we can do that in the future when we get lots of money.
Put the architects to work and let them do something.
Of course. But there are other things we can do meanwhile. But we're going to test. And we'll see. And if the rehearsal passes the test, we will hope to have concerts in our venue as well as the Seabrook.
Seabrook has good acoustics.
Oh no, Seabrook's excellent, but it's a bit small for a big full-on orchestra. So, and then I think I can say that we are in negotiation with the Simon Nkoli Vogue Opera, and that is an amazing piece of theatre. And Simon Nkoli was an amazing man. Famously went to Robben Island with the leadership of the underground ANC then, and apparently convinced the leadership that if they didn't have gay rights in the constitution, then they would have a failed constitution. And we have gay rights in the constitution. And this is a very, very camp, beautiful opera created by Philip Miller and others.
Who has an interesting set of talents of his own.
Yeah, he's an exceptional composer and person. The trouble is money, of course. Mm. So if anybody out there has got some money that they'd love to donate, let's talk. But otherwise...
You're allowed to say that. It's okay.
I'm allowed to say that. Well, I hope we can find a way to do it, because it is an amazing piece of theatre and it's exactly the kind of thing we should be doing. There's a large gay community at Wits. There's a, you know, gender initiatives and activisms, and it's one of the things I'd like to do.
This is a perfect thing for crowdsourcing.
Well, I'm not a very good crowdsourcer type.
Somebody else.
Okay, someone out here might be able to help us, even if it's just to help us find other monies. But what can I say? If we don't manage that well, then we'll be in exam time. And when exams happen, they basically close the venue for public performance. And then we'll have to see what the future holds.
The first crowdsourcing effort I ever heard of in this country was to raise the money to do a film, A Boy Called Twist.
Uh-huh.
20-some years ago.
My goodness. And they did it. They managed.
Everybody who contributed, I think it was $100,000 or something like that. They got listed at the end of the film as an associate producer.
All and that was about as long as the film itself.
Well, it went very quickly.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, well, okay. So we are having a lovely time. And between writing new plays and making this all happen, and trying to pretend I know what budgets are about and HR is about, I'm having a good time.
I hate to ask this. Where do you find, well, I don't hate to ask it. I'm afraid that I'm going to put you on the spot.
Put me on the spot.
Where does the creative impulse for you come from?
I once attended a talk from someone called James Lewis Evans, who was a British director and I suppose intellectual. And he was talking in some theater in Joburg, I'm talking about 50 years ago, maybe. And someone said, well, what makes you a director? And he said he was dropped on his head as a baby.
You got to explain that a little more.
Well, in other words, you don't know where creativity comes from. Maybe you dropped on your head. Maybe I can say that I was highly influenced by my family. My father was a pianist who loved to busk, and busking is linked to improvisation. And my mother was a singer who had to sacrifice her singing so she could become breadwinner. And my father was also involved in selling toys at Greatermans before Sharpville. All of these are clearly some kind of influence on my strange life. But I think sometimes I'm also left-handed, which means
that explains it.
Which means I'm sinister, which means that I'm gauche, which means that I'm not right, and I'm not part of the French law. But the issue is, we know that there's some theories about the right side of the brain being the creative side, and the right side of the brain controls the left hand. I don't know, and I know that I've had a very rich and interesting life, and I'm very grateful and thankful. I love to teach. I love to see the next generation of students making their work at WITS. And generally speaking, I think I'm blessed.
And I think we have been blessed to hear the list of things that you have on the books to take place, the things you want to take place, and the fact that at the modest age of 75, you still have more energy than many people I know have your age.
I would like to believe that I don't need to sleep every afternoon, but often I do.
Well, welcome to the club. A power nap is important.
Absolutely. It was lovely to talk to you.
It has been my pleasure to have you back. This has been the second half of today's program. Malcolm Perkey, our guest. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And next week, we will be back with another program. I'm not sure whether it'll be about nuclear physics or international relations, or township economics, or who knows what. We're never sure. We just move through the universe to pick things that are interesting. And this is the end of our show for today. And you all be safe, be careful, be kind. We'll be back with you again next week at 9 o'clock. Say goodbye.
Goodbye, and thank you, Brooks.